Thank you so very much. I don't think I'm going to go home. They don't treat me like that in Los Angeles. My name is Sybil Doris Adams Stratton Hart Maxwell Willis Corwin, and I'm an alcoholic. Someone was going to leave a watch up here for me so that I won't talk all night. Where is it? Did I just fail to see it? Where? Watch. A watch. So I can get some general idea. Thank you, Dick. Oh, I wish I could move up here. I really wish I could move up here. I have never met such friendly people anywhere in my life. There's been someone to look after me from the moment that I got off that airplane. And with that kind of hospitality and this brand of AA, you must be the soberest bunch of people that I've ever been around. I'm very impressed, and I'll have a lot to tell my husband, Bob, when I get home. He's an AA member. He got sober in October of 1963, but he started to go to Alcoholics Anonymous in 1949. And his father had carefully, on purpose, brought him up to be an atheist. And that's the truth. That's the way it was. And so when he went to Alcoholics Anonymous, why, he loved with his father, adored him, still does. The old man is still alive. He's nearly 90. He's still an atheist. And Bob believed his father. But Bob couldn't stay sober because he would argue with people about a higher power, and it's non-existence. And so naturally, he didn't make out too well. He was a neighbor of mine for many years because I was married a lot, as you can tell by those names I gave you. Lost track of old Bob for a good many years. I was the executive secretary of the central office in Los Angeles for 12 years, and I was married to a man named Jim Willis, who was the founder of Gamblers Anonymous. He was a compulsive gambler. I had never heard that term. I didn't know that there was such a thing. I knew he couldn't quit gambling, but I never thought of it as an illness. And he and Bob were best friends, and there was no doubt about that. And Jim stayed sober for spells, and he would get drunk. And after he started Gamblers Anonymous, he had been sober in Alcoholics Anonymous for 5 years, which was a record for him, and a sweet, gentle, kind, good man. I couldn't say a bad word about that gentle, sweet man who has done or did so much for humanity. But at the Gamblers Anonymous meeting, which I attended with Jim, the fellows after the meeting would go downstairs. They met in the Mayfair Hotel, and the bar was down below. And after the meeting, like we have coffee, the fellows in the Gamblers Anonymous meetings would all go downstairs to the bar. And they'd think nothing of it. They'd have one or two drinks and go home. And so they'd say to their founder, Jim, my husband, whom they adored, come on down with us, Jim. You can have coffee down there just as well as anything else. And he did that for a while, and you know what happened. He got drunk, and he stayed drunk, and a pretty little blonde in the group, about 23 years old, gorgeous little creature, took him away from me. And my heart was broken because I truly loved that gentle man, kind, and he was doing a great deal for humanity. And I just couldn't cope with it. And so one night, I decided I would drive out to the Hole in the Ground, the original group that my brother and I started way back when AA got started in California. And I wanted to talk to its leader. The custom at the Hole in the Ground, and a lot of other groups there, is that if you start a group, you own that group. You're its owner. You started it. You're the founder, you see. And so Duke took the place over when my brother Tex died, and I wanted to talk to him about my terrible problem, about my husband leaving me for that little 23-year-old blonde. And we're out in the kitchen there at the Hole in the Ground. The meeting is over, and everybody else has gone home, and I'm talking to Duke and crying and making a fool of myself. And we heard a terrible pounding. Like we were in the kitchen here, we heard a terrible pounding in the back. Duke said, "What is that? What's going on, Sib? What is that?" I said, "I don't know. What is it? What could it be?" So he went back and opened the door, and it was Bob Corbin, my old friend and neighbor that I hadn't seen for years. And Bob was kicking the door in to get back at AA. And he hasn't had a drink since that night. And that's really, truly a miracle, and that actually happened. Of course, he was just a neighbor of mine for many years. But when I finally lost Jim and I wasn't married any longer, we started going to meetings together. And he was like a brother. I have two brothers. One of them was Tex Adams, a drunk. And I have a brother, a surviving brother, in Dallas, Texas now. And Bob was sort of in that category, if you know what I mean. If you've ever had a buddy that you like to drive you to a meeting, go to meetings with. And this went on for several years while I was working at the central office. And we went down to Palm Springs to the Roundup there. And we were dancing, and we knew a lot of people. They were all big circle members around, not dancing. And one of them hollered, "Hey, Bob! Who's that gal you're with there?" Meaning me. Of course, he knew me. Bob says, "This is the girl I'm going to marry." And that's the way he proposed to me. I had no idea. So that's what we did. We had a regular little church wedding. Went to Hawaii on our honeymoon. And that was in 1967. And he's a wonderful AA member. He hasn't had a drink in all this time. And he loves AA better than anybody I know. There just isn't any question about it. He had a severe heart attack and had a quadruple bypass within the last 6 months. And the doctor told him that the medicine that he had to give him might produce asthma. And Bob laughed his head off. He said, "Doctor, I've had asthma off and on since I was a little boy, so there won't be anything new about that." But there is, because he has severe asthma now, and it curtails him in going to all the AA meetings that he wants to go to. He loves AA better than anybody I know. And he'll be hearing this tape, I imagine. And I'm going to call him up when I get back to the hotel tonight and tell him I want to move here and be with all of you people. And so he's a splendid AA member. Well, I was a hopeless drunk. And I don't know why, and it isn't important. I was raised by a very religious family and a very strict father who wouldn't allow me to go out like the other kids in school with their boyfriend on Saturday afternoon to a matinee. And they did. They went, and I couldn't go. And so Papa said, "I'll never let you leave this house until you're 18 or you're married." So I got married. There was a young man three or four blocks away that I had gotten acquainted with because he lived next door to my girlfriend, and we were inseparable, and Jimmy was a good boy. There was nothing in the world the matter with Jimmy. But there certainly was something the matter with me because we weren't married that many years before we were divorced. And then I married Bill Hart, who was a sailor, and I had a child by him. Her name is Addie Williams, and she's 55 years old now. And she has been sober 6 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. But she didn't tell me. She was afraid it wouldn't work or something. And she waited until she'd been sober a long time. A long time. And then she, I was in Alaska talking somewhere at a convention there. And when I got back to the motel, it said, call your husband immediately. And, I was scared to death. No, it was Grants Pass, Oregon, where I was, and I called Bob, and I was afraid there'd been a death in the family or something really, really tragic. And he said, no, Sib, I didn't mean to scare you to death. He said, I just wanted to tell you that your daughter got her 30-day chip at the meeting in Hollister, California, where she was. She got her 30-day chip tonight at the meeting. I said, what for? She never did drink. And I was really quite angry about it. And so I called her up, and I said, Addie, you're a member of AA now? And she said, yeah, my husband too, Gary. And they were brand new in AA. And I said, well, how come I wasn't notified? And she said, well, Mama, I couldn't do it because I thought I was too hopeless. I just was sure that I wouldn't make it. And after all, I was a little girl in your home, in our home, when you started in AA, and all those AA members there all the time with my brother Tex, and they played poker a lot then in the early days, played poker a lot. And there she was, a little girl, and she knew all those AA members, and she would go with me to the meetings at the Hole in the Ground, at the Sunday night meeting, which was what we called our spiritual group. And she said, I just couldn't bring myself to tell you that I was an alcoholic, but Gary and I have been through 13 years of hell, and we decided it was time that we did go to AA. And she says, I think I stand a good chance. Well, of course, she's still sober. But I don't know that being born into a family has anything to do with alcoholism anyway, and nobody else knows for sure. And I don't know how we catch this thing. I know that from the time I took my first drink that I got drunk and I passed out and I had to be hauled home. And that was the nature of it. I was telling the girls, all these wonderful women that have been with me all this weekend, I'm going to keep in touch with them. I'm really going to do it and get their addresses and everything so that I won't lose them, because they're just beautiful women. And I was telling them how that I lived a few blocks away from my favorite bar, and that I got very drunk, and the bartender threw me out, which wasn't the first time, because I would get mean sometimes and start a fight. I guess I did that night, I'm not sure. But anyway, he threw me out, and it was about a half a mile to my house, or better than a quarter of a mile. A long walk. And so I crossed the boulevard there, and I would go down the sidewalk, and I would fall down. And I would get up, and I would trot. I couldn't seem to walk, but I could run a little bit. And I would run a little bit, and I'd fall down. And then I'd get up and I'd run a little bit and I'd fall down. But I couldn't walk. I just don't understand all that. And finally, when I got up to the steps of my porch, there were a number of steps to get up on the porch. My nylons had come down, and they were hanging out in the back, clear in the back, you know. Just nothing left but the feet in my shoes there. And they were shredded into strings. They were just strings. That's all that was left of those nylons. And you would have thought, well, that would have been enough for her to call Alcoholics Anonymous about, but it wasn't. But I kept on drinking, and things got rougher and rougher until one time I got in my car and I went up to San Francisco, and I was married to this really fine man that had laid the law down, finally, and said, if you ever get drunk again, I'm going to divorce you. And, furthermore, I'm going to get your daughter. You see, Addie was from the previous husband, and he adored Addie, and she loved him. He said, I'm going to take the child, because she's a wonderful little girl, and I'm not going to have her have a drunken mother. So if you ever come home drunk again, I'll have no problem divorcing you and getting that little girl. And that just scared me to death. And so I went to the bar and got drunk, and I got in the car and I started driving. And I drove and drove, and there's an area down there in California called the Ridge Route, which is over a mountain, and the roads weren't good then like they are now. And it was just kind of like a big old muddy, about as wide as all you people sitting that side. And it was muddy and full of chuck holes and everything, and I had a terrible time getting over the Ridge Route and getting out on the flats again on the other side. And when the sun came up, I was in San Francisco. And I looked around. I didn't know a human being. I didn't know why I was there. And I wanted to go home. And I was afraid to go home because he had laid the law down and told me what he was going to do if I ever got drunk again. And I just could not go home. So I turned around and I got back on that Ridge Route, which was up and down and up and down, real bad road. And a man held out his arm for a ride. There's always a lot of hitchhikers trying to get a ride on the Ridge Route. He said, I'll pull the car over, and this man got in the car, and I said, can you drive? And he said, yes. And I said, would you do that? And he said, well, it's okay with you. It's all right with me. So I got in the back seat of the car and went to sleep. That was the end of me. And pretty soon, it seemed like a moment later, but of course it was several hours later, this man shook me in the back seat awake, and he said, lady, we're in Los Angeles. This is where I leave you. I'm going down to Skid Row. Oh, I said, oh, thank you. Thank God you got me back home, or practically home, safe. I'd have never made it without you. So I opened my purse and I gave him the $5 bill and he headed on down to Skid Row. And I sat there in the car thinking, what'll I do? Where'll I go? He'll be gone with a little girl. And I've used up all my lies. And I've told them too often, and he won't believe me. I can't think of a story that'll pass this time at all. What can I do? And I happened to look up, and there was a big sign about the length of that big board over there. And it said, Sultan Turkish Baths. And I had taken many of them because I was fat. I was plump. My brother teased me about it. I was 140 and 5'2", and my cheeks were just fat. And I had been down there to lose weight. You could lose 5 pounds by taking a Turkish bath, and you could put it back on in 2 days, which I did, of course. But I saw that was a good old Sultan Turkish bath, and I thought, well, I'm saved for the moment anyway. I'll take a bath, and I will spend all the rest of the time in that cot there where you can sleep all night, thinking up a lie that he will believe. And when I get home, I won't lose him, or I won't lose the little girl, and it'll work out if I just have time, if I just can get over this to where I can think. I've got to think. And I thought, I'll be awake all night, and, well, I thought I'll read something. I looked, and there was a newsstand right there where my car was parked. So I got out of the car, and I put some money down, picked up the magazine. I didn't even look to see what kind it was. And I went there, and I took this Turkish bath. And after it was over, I picked up the magazine just to tune out. And it was the Saturday Evening Post, and it was dated March 1st, 1941. And on the cover, it was about an inch and a half letters, or at least an inch, on the cover it said, Alcoholics Anonymous by Jack Alexander. And that got my attention. It did, because I had read about it in a Liberty magazine, which is now defunct too. In 1939, Fulton Owsler wrote a short piece in Liberty magazine. 1939, I was at my mother-in-law's home in San Diego, and I happened to pick up the magazine, and the piece was called Alcoholics and God. I read it. It was only a one-page thing at that time. And it said something like this. It won't be accurate, but it's close. That there was a group of men in New York who gathered together regularly for mutual aid. They all had the same problem. They are alcoholics, and so they have named themselves Alcoholics Anonymous. And in 1939, that impressed me so much, to think there was a group of men in New York meeting regularly and talking about the fact that they couldn't quit drinking by themselves. And so there it was in the Saturday Evening Post. And I thought, thank God, this time will be different. I will get word to them. I have another chance. I had a chance in 39 and I blew it. And so I rang the bell for the attendant and told her to bring me a stamp and an envelope and some paper. Because all my life I would have a stamp but no paper. Or I would have an envelope but no stamp. I couldn't get my bills paid. Nothing would work because you've got to have all three. And I knew that. So she brought me the necessary ingredients. And I wrote a most pitiful letter. And I said, I am a woman alcoholic. And I have read your article in the Saturday Evening Post. And please contact me, please, because I will catch the next plane and I'll come and enter your AA hospital. Now, you see the state of my mind in that I thought it was a hospital. But the reason that I thought it was a hospital, because the full page spread showed a photograph of a man on a stretcher, and two men were putting him into an ambulance. In my mind, it was an AA ambulance. They were putting the man in. And so I turned the page, and sure enough, there he is in a ward, there he is in bed, and there's two men sitting there by the bed talking to him. AA members, of course. I didn't know that, but that's what I thought, and I looked at those pictures, and I looked at those pictures. And she brought me the necessary paper, and I wrote right then, I am a desperate woman alcoholic, and I don't want to live like this. I don't want to be like this. I don't know where your AA hospital is, but if you will please get in touch with me and tell me where your AA hospital is, I'll take the next plane and come back there and take your cure. Now, that's not much of a letter, really, but that's the best I could do, and I mailed it. That's a miracle, because I never could get a letter mailed after I wrote one. It'd lay around until it was dusty, and then throw it away and write another one someday. But I mailed that letter, and I went home and waited for an answer. And it came really quick. That is fairly quick, considering that I sent it air mail, and it was a short letter. And it said, you don't have to come back to New York to find Alcoholics Anonymous. There's a group meeting there in your own hometown. They started in December 19, 1939, just several, 3 or 4 of them. But they have a fairly good-sized group now, and they meet every Friday night down at the Elks Temple at 8:30. Please go down and see them. They'll be glad to see you. So my non-alcoholic husband, who was he was a fine man in every respect, and so were his parents down in San Diego, and he had put up with me, so many, many years. Just unbelievable that he had put up with me like that. And he drove me down there, all dressed up in his fine suits and everything, and we went down to the Elks Temple, and there were some long tables, like we have where we serve coffee and donuts, and all big picnic tables shoved together. And there were some men seated around that, and there was 2 chairs empty, and I sat there, and Dick sat there. And that was it. And I didn't look up. I just kept my head down right there. And pretty soon, this very handsome man, just as handsome as they'll ever get, his name was Frank Randall. I secretly adored him. He never did know it. He got up, and he said, this is a regular Friday night meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in California. We're a band of ex-drunks who've gathered together to obtain and maintain our sobriety on an all-time basis with no mental reservations whatsoever. And I thought, what an order. I can't go through with it. Imagine meeting together the rest of their lives on an all-time basis without booze. I thought, I can't go through with it. And then he added, but as is our custom, before the meeting starts, the women will have to leave. So will you please go outside the door? You may wait in the lobby for your husband. And when the meeting is over, your husband will find you, I'm sure. So at this time, let's just, for a moment or two, let's maintain silence while the women leave. And I was the only one. And I knew it. And I got up and put my hands over my face, and I went out that door, and I was never so humiliated in my life. I paced around there, and I paced around there, and I tried to listen. Those big mahogany doors, and I couldn't hear what they were doing. And I finally concluded that they were questioning Dick about my history, my drinking history, and to see if I could qualify. And I made up all kinds of stories in my head to figure out what's going on in there, what's going on in there. I was so curious, I just couldn't imagine. It took them hours. They were in no hurry because that was the only meeting in California. And one fellow came from San Bernardino, his name was Kent Hayden, and another guy came from Laguna, and Curly O'Neill came from Long Beach, and some fellow from Santa Barbara, and then the few local fellows, and that was it. And they were tickled to death to see each other every Friday night. And this meeting went on forever. And when the doors opened and they began to gabble, 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 and they came out, I saw Dick immediately, and I said, I had made up a story in my head that I thought was probably true. I thought, they're doctors, that's what they are. And they're spending all this time asking him questions about me and getting my case history, and they've probably given him some miracle drug to give me to cure me. And I had thought that was the real thing, the real story. So when they came out and I saw Dick, I hurried over to him, and I said, give me my pills and let's go home. And I thought that they would just say, no, Mr. Maxwell, you take these pills and you give them to your wife and she'll be fine from now on. And he shook his head sadly and he said, oh, Sib, you just don't know what they put me through. Poor guy, he never had a drink or anything. There was no pills. And I started crying. I cried all the way home. And when he got out of the car to go in the house, I got behind the wheel and I drove to the nearest bar. And it was the same one I told you about, the nylon thing. the stocking. And I would turn to the guy on my right and the guy on my left, and I'd say, "I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous." And they'd say, "So what?" You know? And that was just awful. And then Frank Randall came out to the house to see me. But I'm not ready to tell you that, because finally the bartender threw me out again, and then I remembered that when I went down to that meeting, I took Ruth Hawk's letter with me, and I had prepared a little speech mentally. And I was, when I went down there to that meeting that I didn't get in, I was going to go up to the man, whoever it might be, and say, "Here, sir, is my letter of authorization from your home office in New York. This letter should entitle me to all the privileges of Alcoholics Anonymous that you possess. Here, take it." And that's what I was going to do. I was going to hand him my letter of authorization. But that didn't happen. And I got so drunk. It was just awful. And then I remembered the letter. See, it was still in my purse because they had told me to leave, I thought. And so I thought, oh, I'll fix their little red wagon. So I opened my purse and I got out that letter from New York. And the bartender, as I say, got me out of there. And there was a payphone booth right outside the door. So I put a nickel in the telephone. That's what it was in those days. And dialed that number. Because down at the bottom, Ruth Hawk, who wrote the letter, had put, "P.S. If you need help immediately, call Cliff Walker. He takes care of all of the new people who come in. And he'll be glad to hear from you." So I dialed this Crestview number, 12345, whatever it was, in Beverly Hills. And this very sleepy voice answered, "Hello." And I said, "Send your AA ambulance and pick me up." He said, "You're drunk." And I said, "Of course. Why else would I be calling?" And he said, "You're really mixed up. That isn't just the way it is." He says, what you should have done was to have gone down to their meeting tonight. I said, "I did." And they threw me out. "Oh," he said, "no, that's not possible. No, there's a mistake here of some kind. They wouldn't have done that." I said, "They did too." He said, "No, we need you. We need you. We've never had a woman alcoholic. We've been waiting for a woman alcoholic. And we need you." Well, I like that part of it all right. Well, I said, "Are you going to come and get me?" And he said, "No, you go home and you go sober up, because I'm going to call Frank Randall in the morning." That was the leader of the group. And he continued to be the leader for 2 years until he was thrown out. And I went back down there, thank God. I mean, sincerely, from the bottom of my heart. I went back down there with Dick, my truly good husband, and I sat there and listened to this man who was, he was a speaker. He had class, and he really made marvelous talks. And then he said, "This is a regular meeting, a Friday night meeting. We're here on an all-time basis, with no mental reservations whatsoever." And I thought to myself, "Forever? Do they mean forever? Oh, I can't do that. What an order. I just can't. I'm not like them, you know." And I was just worrying myself sick about that. And he stopped talking for a few minutes, and he said, "That Saturday Evening Post has saved us, folks." He says, "We have 12-step calls here you won't believe." He said, "The mail has been coming in every day from New York, and it's all in a big carton box." He said, "Excuse me just a moment." And he went off and stayed somewhere and came back with a big carton, about this big, about that deep, absolutely filled with letters that had come in that week from people looking for help with their drinking problem. And he had them bundled into areas like San Bernardino had maybe 25 or 30, and he had tied it up with twine. And then I remember Long Beach had the beaches all the way around from Laguna down past San Pedro had a huge number, 30 or 40 or 50 letters perhaps, and they were tied up carefully. And then the local people, the Glendale and Pasadena and so forth. And what he did, he said, "Here's all these letters from Riverside County, which includes San Bernardino and Riverside. Is anybody here from there?" And the fellow in the back raised his hand and said, "Here." He said, "Come on up here. Get these letters. You go ring those doorbells and you bring those drunks down here next Friday. You hear? And so Kent Hayden went up there and got this big stack of letters, you know, and I'm watching. This is really getting interesting. And then he said, how about the beaches? Anyone here from the beaches? And Curly O'Neill said, here. He said, oh, Curly, I know you. Come on down here. I've got a bunch for you, beginning at about Laguna and ending down there around San Pedro. So come on up and get them. So he went up and he got his stack, you know, and so it went. And finally he got down to the last bundle. And he said, now I've only got one more bundle here. And I'll tell you, folks, there's a little story I want to tell you. An unfortunate thing occurred here last week. A woman alcoholic came to this meeting and we didn't know it. We thought she was one of the wives and that she belonged outside with a non-alcoholic wife. And I believe she's here tonight. And he said, are you Sybil Maxwell? And I said, yes, sir. Yes, sir. He said, well, come on up here, Sybil. And I didn't move. I said, come up here, Sybil. And so I went up and I looked way up at this tall man. I just adored him. And, I mean, he did. He said, the reason I asked you to come up here, Sybil, is we've never had a woman alcoholic, and now you're here, and you're a woman alcoholic, so what I'm going to do, and it's going to be good for us, and it's going to be good for you, I'm going to put you in charge of all the women. And I thought about that, and I grinned a little bit. And I thought to myself, hey, I was thrown out last week, and now I'm in charge. So I took the letters, and interesting letters from women everywhere. One was from Santa Barbara, which is some distance, I guess, maybe 100 miles from Los Angeles. I went over to Huntington Park and made the first call on a big gal, big tall gal, about 6 feet, and she was hefty too, and her name was Irma Lavoni. And I said, you want to come with me and go down and drive to Santa Barbara and call on a girl down there by the name of Helen Pine? I read her letter this morning, and she sounds pretty desperate. And so the first girl I called on got in the car with me, and here we drove down to the Miramar Hotel, lovely hotel in Santa Barbara, and told the desk clerk we wanted to talk to Helen Pine. And she came down with her suitcase, a nice-looking little black-headed girl, about 35, I guess, or 45. And we said, we're from Alcoholics Anonymous. Did you write a letter asking for help? She said, yes, I did. And I said, well, we want to take you into Los Angeles, where it's the only meeting in California. She said, can you just wait one moment, please? Are you in a big hurry? And we said, no, we can wait a minute. She says, well, wait just a minute. And she went over to the cigarette machine and put in a quarter. And just listen to that music. She said, I just love this music. And it was the doggone cigarette machine she was playing. So that's the way it was. And I stayed sober. I can't believe it yet. I really can't. Sybil was in charge of the women. But the big problem was that Tex, they just couldn't stand him because Tex couldn't put up with two men, Mort Joseph and Frank Randall, leaving every week for life. He couldn't stand that. And so he would go down to the probation department because he was on probation for many violations, and the head of the probation department would give him fellows that needed help that were just getting out of jail. And Tex would call, you know, sober him up. And Tex started this group called Hole in the Ground in Huntington Park. And he went back down to the Friday night meeting, and they met him at the door. And they said, yeah, we don't want you. You are disloyal to the mother group that gave you your sobriety. We hear you've started another group. And we've got a group. Look at us. We've got a group. We've got a lot of people now, and you have the nerve to start another group. So we don't want you. We want you to get lost. And Tex laughed and laughed, and he said, I don't know what you're talking about. He said, we've only just begun. He says, I'll lay you 8 to 5 that this is going to be a big fellowship, and there'll be groups. He said, I bet there'll be groups all over Orange County and all over California and all these other states in time. It's not going to stay like this. He said, to have another group out there in another town by the name of Huntington Park isn't going to hurt any. I'm not leaving. You can't throw me out. I'm going to go back here and sit out. I don't know what you're going to do, but I'm staying. And he did. And so there was a big feud. And I would go down there on Friday night, and they'd say, "What's your big brother up to now?" And I'd tell them. And I'd go out there and go back to the hole in the ground, check, and say, "What are they up to down there?" And they feuded around and finally became the best of friends, and everybody got friendly with each other, and I was staying sober. But we weren't staying sober. The announcements that the leader had to make, made it every time, is we're here on an all-time basis with no mental reservations whatsoever. And for the life of me, I can't remember when finally we got the 24-hour plan. It was called the 24-hour plan. And for a long time. And then finally it was changed to a day at a time, as we know it now. And I don't know when all those things happened. It's not important. And life was good. And my brother had a very bum ticker. And I lived 2 blocks from the hole in the ground. And all was well with the people downtown and other groups that Tex had started out there in the southeast area. And there were numerous groups around. But Tommy Butler ran up to my house. I lived about 3 or 4 blocks from the hole in the ground. And he said, Tex had been having very, very serious problems with his heart. And he said, "Hey, Sib, this is it. He's laying on the floor out there in the kitchen and he ain't moving." And that was the case. And he had died right there where he would have wanted to die, right there at the hole in the ground. And I guess he helped countless hundreds, possibly thousands of people that other people couldn't reach because he was a roughneck. He knew their language. He knew what was inside their heads. He knew exactly what to say. And I was amazed when I'd hear him talking to one guy one way and he would be talking to another guy another way. It depended upon the personality of what that guy needed to hear. And he had a marvelous knack at that. And so I went down the hole in the ground. There he was. And the guys that were down there, it's open all the time, still is. It's not a club. It's a meeting hall that's been open ever since 1941. And there's a kitchen. And they make coffee all day, and they have a meeting every night. And that's the way it's always been. And always will be, I guess. And I didn't cry. I adored my brother. I had adored him when I was a little girl. He'd pet me. He was 10 years older than me. When I got sober, he got sober. I adored him. But I didn't cry. And at the meeting that night, the guys went back, and I heard a sound of a hammer. And they were nailing up the door and said, "Out of respect for Texas memory, we're closing the hall tonight." And I said, "Why, what's the matter with you guys? Haven't you got any guts? What do you think Tex would say if he was here and he knew that you just locked up and shut up an AA meeting, a regular group that's been going here all these years? If you are not going to leave this meeting, I will." And that's what I did. And I led that meeting that night. And I shouldn't have done that, but that's what I did. I led that meeting. And I would go down there then every night and smile, and everybody say, "How are you, Sib?" Oh, I say, "I'm fine. How are you?" And I'd say, "I'm fine. How are you?" until I died. I almost died. I had no feelings. I had no emotions. I didn't feel anything at all. I didn't cry. I didn't do anything. And it finally alarmed me. And I didn't go to you and say, "Hey, something's the matter with me." Or I didn't go to you and say, "Look, let's talk. I'm not reacting normally." I wrote to Bill Wilson. Our founder, no less. And I told him about my brother's death. And Tex had been back there and spent Christmas with them in Bedford Hills. And Bill had been out to California a few times, and he came out once with Dr. Bob, and they met at the Shrine. We met at the Shrine Auditorium at that time, and I had the privilege of seeing and meeting and shaking about Dr. Bob's hand, and I was very well acquainted with Bill. He came out quite a number of times, and Tex had a beautiful Christmas season there with him, and it amazed him to go downstairs there in the mornings, and there would be Bill Wilson sitting on the kitchen table eating post toasties. He said, "Imagine it, the founder of Alcoholics Anonymous sitting there eating post toasties." I say, "Well, the man gets hungry, you know." And he said, then he and Lois sat down and addressed all their Christmas cards, and we walked through the snow down to the mailbox, and he said, and Bill was standing there licking a stamp and talking and putting it on the letter and dropping it in the box and licking a stamp and putting it on the letter and dropping. He said, "Can you imagine such a thing from our founder?" And I said, "Yeah, sure can." And so those were just wonderful times. So now that I am nearly dead from grief but don't know it, I write Bill and I lay it out to him about just what I've told you, see? I don't know the words, but it got across very well, I guess, because I heard from Bill immediately. And he said, "Dear Sib, your letter has touched me more than anything that I can recall in recent years. Your story of your brother Tex and your affection for him." He said, "But as for you, my dear, let me tell you this. It's the demonstration that counts." He said, "Life is but a long day in school. And some of our lessons are going to be easy, and some of our lessons are going to be hard. But remember always, it doesn't really matter. It's the demonstration that counts. And I want you to look forward to continuing to go to the hole in the ground and the other groups and continuing your work. I know you're sober, and you have been. You're our lady alcoholic that came when women didn't go to AA except Marty Mann for a long, long time. But I just want to tell you this, that this is a demonstration that this program can work and does work under all conditions, or it wouldn't be worth, well, in my words, a plug nickel unless it would work under all situations." And I realize the wisdom of that. So suppose that when we're happy and it's Christmas time and we're happy anyway, we wouldn't drink. Or if we had a lot of money and we had a yacht and this and that, and we, you know, but let something go wrong and then get drunk. And that's exactly what he was getting at. It was a demonstration that counted. And so I began to feel better, and I got over that pretty well, and I went home from the hole in the ground one night, and my husband met me at the door, and he had been sulking for a long time, and he had been asking me to quit AA. He said, "When you went down there, and I drove you down there to that meeting, I thought they'd give you some medicine or something that would cure you, or I thought that you'd get fixed up and then become a good wife and mother and take good care of this house. Look at everything. Everything's dirty and you're always gone and I'm fed up with it. And so I want you to quit AA now." And I just looked at him and I didn't know what to say. And I came home from this meeting one night and he met me at the door all smiles because he was griping all the time. The women had a hard time of it in the beginning because I would go call on them and I took them to the meetings, and if they were married women, their husbands objected. Alcoholics Anonymous, they didn't know that word. They wanted their wives home to take care of the children, keep the house clean, do the cooking. And a great many of the husbands objected. And they just didn't like that. And Dick was one of the finest men in the world. And when I went home in the hole in the ground one night and he opened the door and met me with a big smile on his face, I couldn't believe it. And I said, "Hey." He said, "Come in, honey. I've got good news for you." And he said, "Let's turn the lights on in the living room and talk a little bit." And I said, "Sure." And so we went in the living room, turned on the lights, and I said, "What is it? What's happened? What is it?" He says, "Well, I've had plenty of time to think. You know, it really wasn't that bad when you were drinking. It really wasn't that bad." He said, "What I want to tell you is that I want you to go back to drinking, and I'll take good care of you, and I won't complain." He said, "Anything would be better than this." I remember now standing here how that I felt the goose pimples come out all over me as I stood there, and I couldn't believe my ears. The man was going to kill me, you know, but didn't know it because he was a fine man. I just couldn't believe it. He said, "Go back to drinking. I'll take good care of you." And he went on upstairs, and I stood there a few minutes. I just didn't know what to do. And I finally went outside, and there was my new car. I had my purse in my hand with whatever money I had taken with me, and that was it. And I looked at that brand-new, black, shiny car, and I thought, "I'm leaving. I have to if I'm going to live, so I mustn't take the car that he bought me. I'll just have to make out on my own." And I caught a streetcar downtown to West Adams Street, which had been a neighborhood of huge mansions, big frame mansions, and very wealthy people lived in them. It was shabby now, and they rented them out as housekeeping rooms with a gas plate and a bathroom across the hall, stuff like that. So I went down and I rented one of those rooms, a housekeeping room with a gas plate and the bathroom across the hall. And the next day I went down to the Times newspaper and got a good job and supported myself. And I went to the hole in the ground, which was quite some long distance from there, on the streetcar. And I never looked back. I never looked back. There was a fine man who's been dead for all these many years, and I'm terribly grateful to him. But if I had lived with him, I would have gotten drunk. I would have had to. I couldn't quit AA. There was no way in the world that I could, and I had to do what I had to do. And I've never been sorry. Now, just because I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't mean that life is beautiful and wonderful every day. I thought, when I first got sober, that because I was sober, that I would be rewarded with a glorious life every minute of it, you know? That nothing bad could ever happen again because Sybil's not drunk. But I found out that I'm a human being and that things come along, and sometimes very bad things. Some, you know, deaths, bankruptcy. I made a bad investment and bought a boxing and wrestling arena with my brother Tex. I let him manage it. And we made, a lot of money. It was in Orange County. We had wrestling on Tuesdays and boxing on Thursdays. And you couldn't ask for a business that made any more money than that. And the popcorn stand and the bar with the beer and the boys up in the stand selling popcorn and like that, peanuts and popcorn. And then TV came along. And every human being stayed home and watched wrestling. And Tex would say, "We got to close her down, Sib. We got to close it down." I'd say, "Never, never. I'll make it work." So he dropped out of it, and I ran the thing. And from being completely filled and up in the balconies and the lodges and everything, nobody came. And the night came that I just locked the door and walked away and sold the building for lumber for $2,000. And that was the end of that. And I went back to an office job, just a silly little office job. I was a good typist. I had worked for the attorney that got me my divorce. And he taught me to be a legal secretary. And so I had no problem getting a job. And I thought that I could make out just fine. And I have had marvelous times. And I've had good times. And I'm so glad that I came in Alcoholics Anonymous when I did. Because I was pretty far gone. And you might say, well, at 32, you couldn't have been too far gone, but I've been drinking 17 years of misery and trying to hide it from a family that didn't approve of it, and I hadn't been raised that way, and I had been baptized in their church. And I felt like I was a rotten person, and I had no feeling of self-worth or anything, and I was a miserable human being. And then when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, they gave me my job, a little job to do, to look after the women. And I thought that would last forever, that Sybil would be in charge. But I went to the Friday night meeting one night, and I'm standing here talking to somebody, and I see Kay Riley walk in with five women. I stood back and I looked. They were strangers, and they hadn't been cleared through me. And I walked back to her, and I said, "Kay, where did you get these women? I didn't give you those 12-step calls. Where did you get them?" And she said, "It's none of your business. I live in Westwood, and all the women that I used to drink with at the Bridge Club, most of them are alcoholics. They watched me stay sober a while. They asked me how I was doing it, and I told them, and they said they wanted to come. So I brought them. And Sybil, I will never report to you again." And I tell you, I was horribly humiliated and embarrassed, and tears came in my eyes, and I didn't know what to say, so I just said, oh, okay. And I walked away from that one. But I would say that Alcoholics Anonymous is here to stay, and we're getting them younger all the time. I heard a little bit, just a little bit of June's tape. I think you had her here Thanksgiving. And I'm her sponsor, and she's a beautiful young woman. And I will never forget the night that I talked at the young people's meeting out in Westwood somewhere a good number of years ago, and I don't know what year that was. And afterwards, a lot of the young people were hugging and squeezing and kissing, which I think is most important in AA. It's a good thing. I like the hugs and kisses because if people weren't friendly and made me feel like you wanted me here, I'd think you didn't want me. And that isn't the way it is. People hug and squeeze a lot there in Los Angeles. And anyway, I was standing there, and these kids were in a line and shaking hands and saying I did well, which maybe I didn't, but didn't make any difference. It made me feel good. And then this tall gal looked down at me, and she said,
Hi, my name is June.
I looked out and I said, how old are you, honey?
She said, I'm 13. And she was.
She hasn't had a drink since. Beautiful young lady. I don't know how old she is now. She talked for you here. I'm sure she told you. It must be, isn't it, close to 20 years, wouldn't you say? Something like that, that our June has been sober. I've always said, and my brother always laughed at me, Sib, you're always so optimistic. I always said that I think that everybody makes AA and stays sober if they live. I'll tack that on. There are people that don't live, but their numbers are fewer because of us. I feel that to be a fact, that AA is available, and that the public in general, they think of us with great kindness, and we have good press. I've never heard anything bad said about Alcoholics Anonymous or its members. I'm very proud to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm very proud to be married to a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 25 years of sobriety. And I'm very proud to be here standing before all of you wonderful people here tonight because you're my very life's blood and I couldn't live without you. So thank you so very much for letting me come.